This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
This afternoon, we're going to be talking about the cutting edge, what's new and upcoming. Eligibility for regional center services is based partly on function and partly on diagnostic label. The definition of the diagnostic label of autism has been through a number of revisions over the decades. It is based on subjective observation of behavior. And the more we know, the more we're understanding that autism includes a wide range of neurology and biology, and autistic people need very different services and supports for very different challenges. Dr. London is going to talk more about the label of autism and what our developing understanding means for more objective diagnosis and for therapies that are better matched to individuals. Dr. London is the director of the Autism Treatment Laboratory at the New York State Institute for Basic Research in Developmental Disabilities, the chief science advisor to the New York State Autism Consortium, and the co-founder of the National Alliance for Autism Research. Welcome, Dr. London.
Thank you. So it's funny that I'm in the cutting edge section because I'm going to be referencing some articles that are 30 years old. But I hope I can put it all together as why is cutting edge. So we're going to talk a lot about the diagnostic label. Just to start, I have no disclosures to make. And another type of disclosure is I'm a psychiatrist and I treat people with various developmental disorders. I am a researcher and I'm also a parent of someone on the ASD spectrum. That's my son, Zach, who is now 38 years old. He was obviously younger at the time of this picture, and so was I. Mentioned that I was the founder of the National Alliance for the next slide. Yeah, I mentioned I was the founder of the National Alliance for Autism Research, and that we started that in the 1990s, and we were the first, I'll call it, major organization that raised money for autism research. Next slide. And if you want to know more about our story, and this is a kind of an interesting book, In a Different Key by Donovan and Zucker, we actually got a chapter in that book. A lot about the way autism was looked at back in the 1990s. Next slide. So when people get the diagnosis, when parents get the diagnosis, now as then, it's still pretty devastating. And what's the next slide? So I took this slide, but I'm really just going to refer you to point number one. The concept of autism is behaviorally based. The diagnosis is of dubious validity and has become a hindrance to progress. We must reconceptualize the nomenclature. That sounds pretty aggressive, but I've published on this a couple of times. And I believe most people in the field actually believe this, although it's hard to turn around the ship. Next slide. So if you're going to read one article that I'm recommending from this talk, this would be it. And it's from 1997. Peter Jensen was the NIH director of child psychiatry at that time. And they wrote this article, The Book of Names, DSM-IV in context. But it's really a beautiful treatise about names, about classification. So they ask, why classify? And we need nomenclature to talk about things. We have to be talking about the same thing. But we can't forget that there's a price to pay for names not being tremendously accurate. It depends who the namers are. If a group of doctors make up, you'll get one set of names. Social engineers will get another. Geneticists will have another set of names. Okay, so at least for medicine, taxonomies or nomenclature or names are not really to look harder or more closely, but rather, and this is paradoxical, I think, is to reduce our awareness by censoring large ranges of an object's features. So, for example, my name is Eric, and everyone can call me Eric, and they'll all agree that I'm Eric, and you know something about me, but in reality, you don't know that much about me. So even though you're getting the right name, the question is, how valuable is that name? It has some value, but it's very limited value. And here's a kicker. In almost all cases of psychiatry, the name given does not describe a natural kind. And I'll talk a little bit more about the concept of natural kind. Next slide. Okay, so I'm sure you're all familiar with the DSM. That's the book of names that the psychiatrists use. And pre-DSM-3, so now I'm talking about the 1970s, psychiatry was the Wild West. Anything went. Every psychiatrist had their own idea of what was going on with their patients, and it was usually based on psychoanalytic thought. And so you can go to 10 different psychiatrists and you might get 10 different diagnoses. At the risk of being removed from the medical profession, psychiatry had to standardize diagnosis. And I'm not actually being flippant here. It was a huge problem. And that's what created the DSM-3. But the problem was that we knew little or nothing about etiology or about pathophysiology. And so how do we create a nomenclature? Well, we did it based on pure observation. So what you see in your office is what you have to base it on. The framers of the DSM-3 actually very plainly told us that this is a poor solution and it should be temporary until we figure things out. Next slide. So Steve Hyman, who was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health at a later date, wrote another paper. And if you're going to read two papers, I would read this one. It's called "A Diagnosis of Mental Disorders, the Problem of Reification." And to this day, we have not figured those things out that we needed to figure out, and we're still stuck with our descriptors. It turns out that the brain is just really complicated. The solution could be to maintain awareness of how limited our diagnoses are, but this is me talking now, but we're not smart enough to do that. And I can tell you that because I watch the way everyone handles the diagnosis. And when I say everyone, I'm even including researchers and doctors and everyone who should know better, reifies diagnosis. Now, reification means making something real that's not real. So instead, we reify and we assign this concrete existence to a concept, which is not a natural kind. So what's a natural kind? A natural kind is something that really exists in nature and we can agree on it. So if I use the word tree, I think we'll all agree that a tree exists in nature. We know that there are different kinds of trees. Some are evergreen, some are deciduous, but we're pretty okay about describing it that way. But a tree is a tree and we can talk about trees in certain respects. Anyhow, the price we pay for poor nomenclature is that things are not working well. We cannot correlate biologic findings with what might be make-believe entities. And so little progress has gone on over the past 50 years. I'm not the only one saying this. The National Institute of Mental Health acknowledges this. By the way, and this is not just for autism, this goes for all psychiatry. The National Institute of Mental Health moved to what they called an RDoC model. And that means studying circuits, not disorders. So they'll do a study on a particular circuit of the brain and what that does and how to manipulate it. And they'll put people in who have all different diagnoses. Very different idea than just taking, well, we took a bunch of autistic people or people with autism and put them in the study. Next slide. So what is diagnosis? And hint is, it's a medical word. So a patient presents to a doctor with an infinite number of data points. You have a history, you have family, you have genetics, you have development, you have lab values, and I can go on and on with all the things that a doctor could potentially be interested in. The doctor must treat the reason for the visit. Therefore, the doctor's job is not to learn everything there is about you, but to narrow down the data. So if you walk in with a sore throat, he shouldn't ask you who you voted for. Anyhow, the doctor must formulate a plan. And that plan could be more tests, more observations, or no, I know enough, I'm going to treat you right away. So the doctor makes a diagnosis, maybe a tentative diagnosis or definitive diagnosis. But it guides the doctor to formulate the next workup and treatment plan. So for example, if you walk in and say, I have a sore throat, the doctor will swab your throat and he won't get kidney function tests. So his tentative diagnosis could be rule out strep throat and he acts accordingly. Next slide. So now we'll shift over a little bit to more specifically autism. So this has been described, some people snarkily describe it as the wise professor model. And I'm going to talk about these three people, Eugene Bleuler, Hans Asperger, and Leo Kanner. I put up this slide because I want to show you that the current nomenclature really began with these people. And these people are, we're talking about 140 years ago. Okay, next slide. So the word autism. Bleuler was the one who introduced the word autism into the medical literature in 1908. He used it to describe a schizophrenic patient who was drawn into his own world. Then in 1943, Leo Kanner published his first systematic description of autism, and he picked that word that Bleuler had used. But Kanner's thought was that it was an innate inability to form the usual biologically provided contact with other people. In 1978, Michael Rutter, who's probably the father of what I would call more modern thought and about what autism is, was asked a question about the true definition of autism. And his answer, I thought, was incredible, by the way. There is no point in starting with the word autism and then defining it. It's merely a word like any other word, and it means exactly what we want it to mean. So this is the opposite of reification. Like there is an autism and we all have to figure out, you know, how do we describe this thing called autism? And he's saying, no, there are things in nature and we describe it any way we want. And we have to assign a word to it. Next slide. Later, even Leo Kanner wasn't happy with autism. So his first paper was 1943. In 1965, he acknowledged his own doubts and recognized the diagnostic heterogeneity, and he opined that children had not read the diagnostic manuals and they didn't fall clearly into any clear-cut categories. And he said that no matter how well-developed our criteria gets, each child must be treated as a unique individual. Next slide. So the question could be asked, is autism a valid diagnosis? But I'm going to get picky again, and I'm going to go over the word valid. So here's four different kinds of validity. First is face validity. Well, that's whether the description of a category and its diagnostic criteria accurately describe the disorder. Well, I would say no, because autism is so heterogeneous. That no, if I say autism, you don't know what I'm talking about. It could be hundreds of different people don't look anything alike. Okay, number two, descriptive validity, whether the features of a category are unique to that category relative to other mental disorders. Again, I would say no, people with autism have to be, let's say, repetitive, but people with obsessive compulsive disorder are repetitive. So no, the descriptive validity is not so good. Predictive validity, how much does it predict the course, the complications, and the treatment response? And I would say it doesn't at all, because we can't tell anything really about prognosis just by giving a diagnosis of autism. And fourth, external or construct validity, the extent to which a diagnosis correlates with expected external validators, such as neurobiological markers. And this is where people have become really, I mean, when I say people, I mean scientists, have become really, really upset, because everyone thought, wow, if we just get, actually, Francis Collins, who just stepped down from the head of the National Institute of Health, said if we get 200 SIB pairs, we'll crack the genetics of autism. Now we probably have a couple hundred thousand. We still haven't cracked it. So is autism a valid diagnosis? I would say no, and actually I've published that it's not. So next slide. Let's skip this because I kind of ran through these things. So this is for visual learners. Is this one disease? Okay, next slide. So who uses these reified diagnoses? Well, first, a range of service providers. Now, the service provider is trained in a skill, like an occupational therapist, a speech therapist, a psychiatrist. And okay, now I have a diagnosis of autism. So how much does that tell you about what treatment is needed? Well, I'll tell you, as a psychiatrist, it tells me almost nothing about what treatment is needed. Instead, we're trained to provide a service. And so you've probably all heard that if you're a carpenter, the whole world looks like a nail. So whichever practitioner you go to will apply their treatment to this vague diagnosis. Policymakers and government, what services are paid for? What is needed? And I'll give you an example of the problem. Neurodiversity people picketed the opening of a new group home in New York State. And they were saying that we don't need group homes, we need to be in the community. Well, the people who were going to get into that group home weren't people who were going to easily integrate into the community. Now, the state officials, and I worked for New York State, so I heard this firsthand, were very alarmed. And they said, well, if the community doesn't want group homes, why are we wasting money on group homes? Now, the people going into the group homes were people who weren't making it at home. They were banging their heads against the wall. They were doing self-injury or hurting their family. So by having poor nomenclature, we have situations like this with the government. Insurance companies, well, the insurance companies, you know, everyone kind of knows they want to get out of paying. So I prescribe drugs, and very often I get my drug denied because they say this drug is not indicated for autism. Well, I'm not really treating autism. I'm treating hyperactivity, or I'm treating aggressiveness. But the insurance company doesn't understand that, because you're supposed to treat a diagnosis. Educators, does my program work for autism? MDs not familiar with the diagnosis have a real tough time knowing what to do. Now, I'll talk more about that later. Even family members, many people who are parents say, my child should be integrated into the classroom or the community. And many people who are parents say, my child should have their own services and their own spaces where they can thrive. They can't thrive in an integrated environment. So is there one answer to all these things? No, it has to be individualized. Next slide. Okay, and this is for me, the diagnostic solution. I have suggested that we stop using the word autism and that we use the word developmental disorders with features of X. Well, that means you have to do something that I'm going to call an assessment. An assessment is, what problems does this individual have? Not what diagnosis does a person have. If we can't have a diagnosis that's meaningful, what we have to focus on is assessment. And I don't know how to explain this to all those other people I had in the previous slide, but what we really need is good assessment. Okay, next slide. Okay, so we have problems integrating into the existing systems. Next slide. Now, this is where I'm going to get a little bit cutting edge. So when you're born, the brain is 25% developed. At about 2 years of age, it's about 75% developed. And when you're 5 years old, it's about 90% developed. So what's the average age of diagnosis of autism? It's 4 point something, and that's even in America, and the rest of the world's probably even later. But average age is 4 point something. And so many, many, many people are not diagnosed till after the age of five. So what is that saying? That we're diagnosing people with autism after their brain is 90% formed. So if we were going to be, if something's going wrong pre-birth, which is actually something that we know is true, if we want to have a chance of intervening and we wait till brain development is nearly concluded, we're sort of missing the boat. I'm often given the question, well, supposing we could identify them earlier, what would we do? Well, we can't know until we are able to identify them. Next slide. So I want to talk about the problems with very early identification. Autism cannot be diagnosed reliably until, I wrote 24 months, probably 18 months is closer to truth. The problem is that we're using behavioral symptoms, and these, we have to wait for neurotypical people to develop these skills so we can see where people are diverging. And I already mentioned the average diagnosis, and half are not diagnosed until after 6 years of age. Next slide. So the current system is that screening and diagnosis are supposed to be done in the physician's office. In a recent study of 20 clinics serving 36,000 toddlers, 73% were screened. That's much better than national average, by the way. The sensitivity of the AmChat, which is the most commonly used screener, was only 33%, and the positive predictive value was 17%. Positive predictive value basically means what's the chances that we're getting it right? And chances are 83% we're not getting it right, which means the other way of saying is these are all false positives. And you can play with it, but it's very, very difficult to get a meaningful very good early screener using behavioral methods. Even a somewhat ideal setting where there was 91% screening, the positive predictive value was still only 14.6%. So the primary care office is the location best positioned to offer consistent, timely, accessible, culturally responsive care. But they struggle with being able to do these screenings and making referrals. Only 28 to 60%, depending on the study, administered standardized screening tools, even though the American Academy of Pediatrics is working very hard to improve that. Next slide. Okay, and this slide is even more disturbing. This study that I'm quoting here was done in Washington State. Now, screening is only meaningful if it leads to intervention. So in a study they did of 14,000 children with developmental disability or delay, it was found that only 18% of those who were early intervention eligible received a referral to early intervention. So wow, we're down to like, 82% don't even get referred. Out of the ones referred, 26% Only 26% of those actually made it to early intervention, meaning only 5% of those eligible children made it to early intervention. It's really hard for PCPs, and I'm not throwing stones at anybody. PCPs are under increasing stress. I think the national average is you're supposed to see a patient every 12 minutes. And there's more and more pressures, as they might say, to crank them out. So to add screening, quality screening is very difficult. Next slide. So more than half the PCPs surveyed expressed a need for more knowledge, more training, and a similar number listed more knowledge about community resources. In other words, the PCPs don't really know what to do, at least many of them or most of them. Next slide. So solutions, so I actually have a grant for prospective solution. It's a 1 year small grant, but going to try. Anyhow, to create an entity whose task it is to undertake screenings. This, oh, by the way, I should say that I don't know the California system. So if California is way ahead of me on this, then I apologize. But I'm coming from New York State and from what I know nationally. But anyhow, create an entity whose task it is to undertake screenings. This will be done by people who could be trained fairly easily, done outside the PCSB office. We're actually doing it online. We're enrolling people at birth in a hospital, and we're going to follow them online. I'm going to talk more about neurophysiologic lab tests, but I'll save that. And anyhow, this entity could not only do the MCHAT type screening, but we have more time, you know, than a busy pediatrics office, and we could do level two screeners, which would have a much better rate of positive predictive value. And if you could add some physiologic testing to it, we would be extremely good. Next slide. And so my research on early detection, we're using EEG, but it's not standard EEG. We're using a kind of an AI or machine learning EEG. It's called nonlinear EEG. We've been able to separate out autism from non-autism as early as 3 months of age in a infant siblings population. ABR is auditory brainstem evoked potential, and we did that with premature infants. Now, ABR is done in most states on a majority of patients. It's a hearing test. We could do it as a test for autism, we think, and all we would have to do is turn the volume up a little bit. And so it's readily doable. And the third thing is movement analysis. Now, when a baby is first born, its movements are completely random. But as the baby matures, the movements get to be more intentional. In our preliminary work, we're finding that by 3 months of age, if the baby's intentionality has not gotten better, that may be predictive of autism. We have less data on the movement analysis. These are all easy tests to do. The EEG, we could do it in 2 minutes. And the movement analysis, you could do with a cell phone. Next slide. Okay. So... you can put up to the next slide. Okay, so this is the loop. We could do these very easy tests. We send it to a central location where it's analyzed, and the results can go back to the pediatrician or the PCP, and it'll be just like a lab test. And we think this is extremely doable right now. We've done it on high-risk populations. We need to do it on non-high-risk populations, but so far... the granting agencies have not agreed with us. Okay, next slide. Okay, skip this slide because I'm running out of time. This is the ABR, and you could see how easy it is to separate out. The red peaks are autism. So this is brainstem evoked potential. You do a few clicks, and we see when the peaks come in the brainstem, and you can see that the peaks are coming late. in every single peak, separated out very easily. Next slide. And this is just what I was telling you about, you know, with doing the babies and the tensional movement. Okay, next slide. So I just want to mention one more thing, and I'll tie this up with diagnosis a little bit. So in Boston, there's the at Mass General Hospital, there's the Healy Center for ALS, so amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And they came to the conclusion that they couldn't really test treatments for ALS with the usual system, because the usual system is clunky, it takes a long time. And it's so what they did was they create next put on the next slide. They created, they're using something called a platform trial, which basically means you get admitted to the study, you can get standard of care, treatment one, treatment two. But then what happens is after a brief amount of time, if the treatment's not working, you stay in the study, but you drop the treatment that's not working and you get into another. And one of the treatments could be placebo. And they're finding that they could do these studies very quickly, and they're not subjecting these poor people who are going to get sick very quickly to these extended trials. I think this would be pertinent for autism and developmental disorders, and largely because we have such a heterogeneous population that the idea that we have to develop one drug for one diagnosis is never going to work. It's just going to be, we're just banging our heads against the wall. Okay, next slide. So if anybody wants to ask me questions, this is my email. Feel free. If you want to harass me, that's okay too, on email. It's a, can't have my phone number, but you can. I'm pretty open to any email suggestions. Next slide. And this is me and my son, Zach, now, who I said is 38. And he lives on a great program on a farm, and he's a really happy guy, and I've aged well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. London. I think as we, although some of the information may not be new ideas, I think they take on a new salience after 30 years of autism research. So I think we need to go back and look at where we've been and where we're going. There's a question in the chat. Could the PPV of the MCHAT also be impacted by parent report, which may result in a child being noted at a lower risk than if other providers completed it based on their observations of a child?
Well, I'm not sure I can give a great answer to that. I'm not a specialist in these particular tests. There are all sorts of screeners, and there are many. The AmChat is the one that's caught on, and partly because of its brevity. See, they're with the level one screeners. Now there are level two screeners, which are much, much better, but they take 20 minutes to 40 minutes to do, and they're done by observers, not the parent. So you can't do, the PCPs aren't going to do level two screeners in their office. That's, when I say they aren't, maybe there's a rare exception, but it takes too much time. So they're referred out to quote unquote experts to do the level two screeners.
Another question from the Q&A, was the 3 month old prediction study with siblings extended out longitudinally?
That was the EEG study, I guess. They were followed to diagnosis. I don't remember how long they were followed, but they were, you know, it wasn't, I mean, you don't get diagnosed at 3 months. They were diagnosed at, you know, when the ADOS or you know, was able to be done.
The diagnosis of autism now has great social salience for a strong autistic community and political in terms of eligibility for services. It's written into statute as part of California's definition for lifelong eligibility for services and supports. How would you recommend we deal with that when it doesn't match the science and biology?
Yeah, I mean, I hate when people say it's a great question, but that one's a great question. I don't have the answer, but what I can say is we got ourselves into this mess, and no one's going to get us out of it. It has to be the medical scientific community has to tackle this issue. If we made a mistake, or if we didn't choose a good nomenclature, at some point we have to say, look, our nomenclature is not good, we're going to move on. Now, if the rest of society says, we don't want you to move on, it's a huge problem. And the rest of, actually, I've written papers saying this is a bad diagnosis. And the critique I've gotten, as a matter of fact, we had a back and forth in one of the journals with some people. The critique I've gotten is, well, what are we going to do with the rest of society? You know, they believe autism, they've reified autism. Even if we know better, you know, we can't just pull the rug out from under them. Well, I guess we have to. I mean, wouldn't we do that if we found out something in another form of medicine was wrong? Like we're using a medicine that's harmful, or we made a mistake. You know, it's not a mistake. We did the best we could at the given time. But I think we have to. When the DSM keeps being revised, people are trying to make it better. But I personally don't believe it's going to get better as long as we're using diagnosis and behavioral symptoms. I think we're in a loop, and we're not going to get out of that loop.
So there's some more diagnostic questions. One is whether eye tracking in the pediatric offices is a promising development.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the three measures that I've been involved with. But there's, you know, there could be many, many valuable ways to do biomarkers. I believe the UCLA group has used MRI and had fantastic results looking at very, very young kids and predicting who was going to get the diagnosis. MRI is obviously not the kind of thing that you could do easily in a PCP lab. Eye tracking also is a little harder, although the technology, you know, maybe some, you know, very soon we'll have these glasses and, you know, we could do eye tracking very easily. So the field could be wide open. It's just that we have to be able to make a priority about integrating these different biomarkers. I'm calling them biomarkers. Strict definition are not yet biomarkers because they don't pass the test, but these biologic findings into our clinical work.
Fantastic. There's another question that might be too specific, but I'll ask it anyhow. An audiologist saw a patient with autism for a sedated ABR on Wednesday who had delayed latencies. If she sees a prolonged ABR latency on a child who's in the process of being diagnosed for ASD, do you think the child needs a referral to neurology?
Well, I think the quick answer is I'm not sure what a neurologist would do with that in terms of treatment. I'm not quite sure, you know, if you have a finding of delayed latency, that's what we find in, by the way, you find it in children with autism. We do not find it in adults with autism. That thing seems to be, you seem to outgrow that. So the question, I think a different question would be, what should we be doing with delayed latency? And that's a good question. There may be treatments, like, for example, various types of stimulation, like transcranial stimulation or But first, we have to get serious about caring about these markers.
Wonderful. And there was one final comment. This is a comment, not a question, but I see a lot of families confused when they have a medical diagnosis of autism, but when doing a school IEP, they find they don't meet educational criteria for autism in terms of their eligibility. And likewise, the autism diagnosis isn't a guarantee of regional center services. So I appreciated this presentation and the nuances around the diagnosis.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there shouldn't be an educational diagnosis of autism, because it's a medical diagnosis. I don't even think it should be a medical diagnosis, but it is a medical diagnosis. But the educational intervention should be based on assessment, as I was saying, should be based on what kind of a learner you are, what do you need, what services would help you learn, not how does it fit into this box. And I think I beat that one to death.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. London.
Okay, my pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.